How long have you known me?
What's over 10 years.
Yeah, I guess that's all you need to know. Let's get out of here.
But like,
how often do you just sit down with your friends and have completely candid conversations with them about life and, you know, the things that you go through and have you learned from them? Have you not learned from them? And where do you go from there? I think that's the good thing about these sit downs that you've put together. I think it gives people hope that you can do it. And it's something that's good for the soul, I guess you could say.
Welcome back. Here we've got another episode for you guys with one of our own, one of our co-founders and instructors here, Mike Diaz, who I've known for well over 10 years. We've got Pat here behind the camera, crushing it for us again. And it's been a long time coming. I want to say thank you to Mike for giving us the opportunity to sit down with him and for him to tell his story and, you know, all the mix of life and things like that. It's just time's kind of gotten in the way. So super excited now that it's like the new year and being able to tell people your story, your comeback story, and all that other stuff in between that I think would be, that might help somebody that's out there that's really going through what you've already gone through, right? And currently what you're going through, right, is like a single dad. So with that thank you, Mike. And let's kick it off with where you grew up, what that was like, what school was like, sports, you know, everything leading up to join the military.
Yeah, man. So as Chad said, I'm Mike Diaz. So born originally in Kentucky, small town. Don't remember anything about it, obviously. But I really call home Columbia, South Carolina. That's where my mom, who was a single mom, kind of paved her way into what she is now. So she's a retired teacher now teaching in the Cumberland County School District. I really call home Columbia, South Carolina. So 36 years old, single dad, got three kids. I got a 12-year-old, a 9-year-old daughter, and a 6-year-old boy. So it's been a challenge, but it's been good, you know, up to this point. Learned a lot of things along the way, a lot of things that I probably should have done different, but it's been good, man. You brought up some things like my past, man. As a high schooler, I was probably your typical high school kid. You know, I did all the sports. I played baseball. I played football. Wasn't really into soccer or anything, but I got two kids that are big into soccer now. And then I played basketball. I did everything, man. It really was just to kind of keep me out of trouble because, you know, they say a kid that's not busy is a kid that's going to find himself in some trouble. So I tried to stay busy, and my mom ensured that that's how she kept me out of, you know, probably handcuffs later in life. But I still had my issues along the way, even with her doing the best she could as a single mom. Baseball was probably my biggest passion. Not a lot of people knew about that. But my dad was a former minor league player. Didn't know my dad. I think that's probably one of the biggest things that we'll get into this podcast that has shaped me today. But he played baseball. Wasn't something that I looked up to him with, but my mom would talk about him and his, you know, his success and then ultimately his failures in life and where he went wrong. I mean, I think there's a lot to learn from him and how I shape myself today, even though that he's not around. But big into sports, kind of looked up to the baseball and to keep myself pretty humble and, you know, kind of steadfast in my ways going forward. So kind of just a normal life, man, if you really kind of unpack it. I mentioned my mom who was single. She just never really remarried. I actually remember something she told me one time. I asked her when I was about 17 years old. I said, "Mom, why'd you never remarry?" And she looked at me and she said, "I didn't think you'd like any of the guys that I'd bring around." And I'm like, "What?" Like thinking like I'm the problem now, right? Like I'm not the problem, Mom. Like, but ultimately I think her focus was the kids, and that's kind of where I'm at now in my life, is like the kids are my focus. Now I'm open to, you know, meeting somebody, but it's not a primary goal right now. Right now, really focused on myself and kind of getting out there and doing the things that I probably should have done a long time ago. But seemingly normal life growing up, man. Sports really drove me who I was and taught me a lot about who I am today. I think the biggest thing that you learn out of you know, sports is just a, it builds a good work ethic, and it develops a character for somebody, right? One thing a lot of people don't know, but my grandfather had a big influence on my life, and he taught me a lot about just being humble and being a man of character. And I think that that has really resonated with me as I've gotten older, and what I want to instill in my two boys. And ultimately, you know, my daughter needs to see men who are being raised right, because she deserves the best in life too, you know. I was 17 years old, man, sitting in high school, didn't have a clue what I wanted to do with my life, right? I think you share a very similar story in some of this. Didn't really know which one. The Army was the last thing on my mind at 17 years old.
What's crazy is it was the first thing on my mind.
Yeah, so.
And that's just because I didn't like school, right? And right. I, like you, I played sports, you know, rode motocross. I did things that developed a lot of character, but I didn't realize it at the time.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't realize it at the time.
I mean, I coach baseball now. I coach my son's travel baseball team, and you know, he gets so irritated with me because I'll go make him hit off a tee.
Yeah.
And he thinks it's, you know, my dream for him to make the majors. That's his dream, right? You know, I could care less what he ends up being in life. What I want him to build is a work ethic towards something that he has set his mind to. So his goal is to be the best that he can be. He's a great kid. He's a great student. So baseball is only a part of his life. It's only a part of my life, right? And it was only a part of my life back in the day as well. But, you know, when someone tells you to put a ball on a tee and just go at it, you know, and just go at it, you're building a foundation of success for the future, right? Even if you aren't, you know, even if you ultimately don't meet your goal, it still has a building block towards your future, right? But, you know, like I said, the Army was the last thing on my mind. I was a terrible student, man. Like, bottom of my class. I had a lot of friends, you know, because I was a class clown. Like,
this hasn't changed.
No, I mean, I think it was it's kind of fitting. But, you know, 17 years old, my mom looked at me and she's like, "You're going to go to college." And I'm like, "Oh, this is going to be awesome." So I get to, you know, my senior year and I'm like, "How am I going to go to college? Like, I don't have the grades to go to college." At the time, I would not consider myself smart, you know, and I know that's very subjective in many ways. But I didn't think I had the work ethic to do what I needed to do to be successful in college. Even though, as I mentioned, you know, the foundation and the building blocks have always been there. I just didn't know my potential at the time. And I, you know, I'm talking to my mom and I'm like, "Mom, I'm never going to get into some D1 college or some, you know, big school in the area." She's like, "That's fine. You can just go to this little college called Midlands Tech." And I'm like, that's like a mile down the road, man. Like, so I'm like, I got to stay with my mom for the next 4 years and like figure it out. Like, I already don't want to be here, but you know, I think that's a lot of boys at that age. They're like, "I got this. I'm 18 years old. I got this." And mind you, I'm working at a zoo making like $10 an hour. And I'm thinking I'm rolling in the dough, man. Cause it's like $3 more than minimum wage in South Carolina. So I'm like, I am really big time right now. I can pay for my cell phone bill. I can pay for my gas. I'm paying for my, you know, the car that I'm driving at the time. And I'm thinking to myself, like, I can do this, you know?
What were you doing at the zoo?
I was a warehouse manager for their concession stands that were going on there. Yeah. So not even dealing with the animals, man. Like, it's not even a cool job, but you know, it was a good job. It gave me a little bit more responsibility than I was used to. And I think it also in some ways were part of that building block that I had, right? Because it started to kind of, if you will, I mean, I'll use this kind of a, but it kind of got at that scab, you know what I'm saying? Like, if you pick at it enough, you're going to make it bleed and it's going to rush over. So I use that analogy just because the more and more that I kind of poured into myself, the more and more I got, you know, I gained a little bit more success in some things. So I'm working this job and, you know, graduation comes, I do graduate, so I will tell everybody so they know, like, your boy did graduate high school, okay? It wasn't great, but I do have the certificate. So I graduate, and I remember seeing all my friends, they're like, I'm going to Coastal Carolina. They're going to these big schools. They're doing all this stuff, and I'm thinking to myself, like, man, what am I going to do, you know?
You're about to go a mile down the road.
I'm about to go to a mile down the road and, like, stay with mom for the rest of my life. And I'm like, I'm going to be the typical, you know, dude who's living with his mom for the rest of his life, right? Not really, but, you know, that's a thought that's going through my head. And I didn't have a clue. So she takes me down there. She gets me enrolled. And not knowing anything, I'm like, I want to be a physical therapist. That was the first thing that I enrolled in. And I had no interest in being a physical therapist. Like, I didn't know what that actually entailed. Dude, I got in the first semester of classes and it was an absolute disaster, dude. It was like withdrawal failing from two classes, failing in another class. And, you know, her connections being where she is, she ended up helping me out and she got me, you know, these grades that ended up not ultimately hurting my GPA, but it was like, you need to figure out what you want to do with your life. And I'll never forget, I'm sitting in my bedroom with my buddy. We'll just leave him Nick. I don't know if he wants his name, but Nick is in the bedroom with me. We're playing video games. And at the time, I don't know if you ever played Gears of War.
That's an old one.
Yeah. But that's what came out at the time. And like, we, as the kids would say today, like, we grinded on that game. Like, we were grinding pretty hard, right? He didn't really have his, I would say at the time, he didn't really have his life figured out either. Like, we were both just trying to figure it out, right? And she came in and she had a fire up her ass, dude. Like, and I'm like, oh God, she's pissed about something. Like, what did I do wrong? Well, she got a hold of my report card. Well, I guess at that time it was just my, you know, the transcript from Midlands Tech. And she's like, you failed out of college. You have one of two choices. And, like, mind you, man, like, this is 3 years after we have, you know, gone in Iraq and Afghanistan. I remember 9/11 being, you know, in eighth grade, kind of like in awe of what happened, and it glazed over. We got kicked out of school.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, like,
I was thinking about that last night when the kids were watching something, and they were like, "Is that what they talk about 9/11?" And I vividly remember, like,
yeah,
it happening, like.
That's kind of where I was at, man. Like, I remember it happening and remember, like, you know, all the adults around me crying. And I was just getting into U.S. history. And, like, we did, like, at that time, like, I wasn't, like I said, I wasn't very, I didn't listen to my teachers in school.
No, me either. I didn't understand the
magnitude. I didn't understand what was going on. I was in eighth grade, you know?
Yeah.
But I knew that something bad had happened, you know? That's what I knew. And I think, you know, at that point, the patriotism that started to ensue around the country obviously became a pretty prevalent thing for us to see. Flags were everywhere. People were, you know, coming together. And it was a good time, man. Like, at that time, I thought, you know, we were living some of the best days, if you will, because everybody loved each other. And I think that it was a monumental moment, obviously, in our history. But the Army was an afterthought. And she came in with brochures, man, and I know I'm jumping back and forth, but they're all kind of tied together. And I looked at her, and I was like, you want me to do what? I was like, the Air Force? I was like, I don't even know how to spell Air Force. What's the Army? Like, and she's like, these are your options. Or you figure it out, and you go find a job, and you, like get your shit together. And I'm like, all right. So I think that was Friday. I think I looked at Nick and I was like, I don't think you should be here anymore. And he's like, yeah, I should probably go home. And so Monday rolls around and I go to she takes me down to the recruiter station, and man, I can't remember my recruiter for the life of me, man. He was so, the dude didn't do me wrong, but he was like, out the door. Like, when
he didn't do you wrong, but he didn't do you right.
He didn't do me right. You know, he was like, you're the last, you know, candidate I'm getting into the Army. I'm retiring this summer. And I'm like, okay. And I remember, the only thing I really remember about this dude is that he sped like a motherfucker down to the place that I took the ASVAB, which was in Augusta, Georgia. And the one thing he said to me that really stood out was like, he's like, I'm a paratrooper from the 82nd Airborne. No cop's going to catch me. I'm like, what? What does that even mean? You know? And he sees a cop and he slows down. And I'm like, I don't know what this means, you know? And we get back to the recruiting station and he looks at me and he's like, you can have any job you want in the Army. Tell me what you want to be. And I'm like, what does that even mean, man? Like, I'm thinking to myself, like, any job, like, you're supposed to tell me what the job, what jobs are available to me. Like, and he looks at me and he says, what do you like? I was like, I don't know, man. I like video games.
I like Gears of War.
I'm like, I like Gears of War. Like, he's like, no, like, what are you? I was like, dude, like, I'm the wrong person to be talking to about this whole idea of like what I want to, because I don't have a clue what I'm want to do in life. I was like, oh, I think I like, oh, that's awesome. The dog's pissing in the background. But
hey, buddy,
thinking to myself,
that's how you know it's real.
I don't know what I want to do. I think I vaguely mentioned to him, like, my mom's a computer teacher. He was like, perfect. You're going to be a signal support specialist. And I'm like, what is that? Like, what does that even mean? You know? And little do I know, like, it was actually a very valuable skill to learn. Like, I got to dabble in, you know, that's what I was at the time. So I joined the Army as a signal support specialist. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, all right, what's next? He's like, well, you got to go to basic training. And I'm like, okay, well, at this time, you know, they're dishing money out left and right. And like, if you leave in like 20 days, you can get like a $40,000 bonus. I'm like, well, sign me up, man. Like, you know, this time we're like, all we see is the whole numbers, you know.
We're just like,
40K, like, this is going to be great. You don't think about like, well, Uncle Sam's going to get his, and then you're like left with whatever. And then he also got me, like, he got me on a 6-year contract. And I'm like, dude, I'm married to this for 6 years. And then I said, all right, well, sure, man, sign me up. Like, I'll go. And then he says, well, you're going to go to basic training at Fort Jackson. I'm like, dude, I got to get away from here, man. Like, this is too much, man. My friends barely know me anymore. Like, my mom hates me. She needs me to leave, you know. Like, sending me to Fort Jackson is, like, the worst thing you could do for me. Because I'm not really leaving home at this point. You know, that's in Columbia, South Carolina. So I ended up going to basic, and basic's probably like everybody's experience. You know, I think it really changes who you are, because what, you know, the Army does is it tries to strip you of your identity and make you part of a team, right? And I think that they did a pretty good job of that. So that's how I ended up getting in the Army, man. And you know, my first duty station was Fort Lewis, Washington. So you take
there, you got away.
There's where I get away, right? And as soon as I show up there, man, it's like you hit the ground running. Like, at that time, they're deploying people left and right. So I caught two deployments while I was out there. And
so when did you get there? You came in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So you got there in 2007.
Yeah, I got there in 2007.
It had to be, because you and I are on the same path, so.
Yeah, dude, no, I deployed. So I showed up and
had to be, what?
It was like 2 months when I got there, and I was out the door.
Like, okay.
So that was the first time that I really, like, you know, I guess you could say I saw the world, right? So deployed to Iraq, wasn't there for the full rotation because they were on their way back, and they actually got extended. So that unit I showed up to got extended, and I was on the tail end of that. And then we came back, and it's the typical, you have the pipeline of training that you go through, and then you deploy again. I caught my first full deployment in 2009.
Okay.
When we went back.
So they got back, you deployed in 2007. You got back in 2008.
Yep.
So that just shows you, right? Like,
just
packed all that stuff in there for a year and then back out the door.
Yeah, man.
Back to Iraq, right?
Yep, back to Iraq. And I would say that it was that. So the first deployment was, it was the sketchy one. It was the typical the time in Iraq where everything was, you know, unhinged, if you will. The rules were off the chain, like, you know, the ROE was basically, you know, if someone's pointing something at you, you know, take care. Now, I'm a signal support specialist, so I want to make it very clear, like, I'm not dealing with what the CAV unit that I was with, those guys that are going out there all the time. But I was the commander's RTO during the time, so I got to, I had my fair share of things, you know. But what I will tell you, I'll tell you one story while I was in Iraq. Like a week after showing up there, I'm PV2 Mike Diaz, like don't have a clue what's going on.
Dragging, you know, your bags just from like, the flight, you know, line.
Yeah, like I'm pretty fit, pretty in shape guy, because, you know, basic training and AIT got me in pretty good shape. And the NCO that picks me up, it's the C7, he's like, oh yeah, he's like, you're going to be all right. And I was like, what does that mean? I was like, he's like, you're going to be the commander's RTO. I obviously, now knowing what I know in the Army, like they obviously like had these positions kind of these picked out. But the first assignment, I guess you could say, my NCO gave me was to go up and fix an OE-254. For the guys out there that don't know anything about that, that's this big antenna, and it still exists today, but there's a lot of easier ways to erect an antenna, right? He's like, you need to go up there and fix that antenna. I said, okay. I'm like, I'll go up there and fix the antenna. So I like strap everything up and I get on the roof and I'm climbing a ladder. I'm like, God, dude, I've got like 900 pounds on me. Like, this is terrible. And I'm about to go up here and, you know, fumble fuck with this antenna. And there's a sandstorm coming. I guess they called the haboobs or what? I think that's what they were called. But we'll just leave it. It was a sandstorm. Well, not only did the sandstorm happen, right before the sandstorm happens, we start taking fire on our cop. I'm like, oh, hell. He's like, you got to get that antenna up. That's why we're, he's from BFE, Missouri, man. Like, he's got an accent, much like myself, but like way worse, you know? And he starts screaming and yelling at me. And I'm like, Sergeant, I can't see. Like, there's mortar rounds coming in. Shouldn't I get to the bunker? He's like, stay up there and fix it. I'm like, okay, the commander's got to talk. He's like, you don't want that to be your first impression. You can't get the antenna up. And I'm like, dude, all right. So I do whatever I can. I straighten it out and I get down and I'm like, I can't see anything. And I've got like sand all in my face and everything. He's like, all right, you can go to the bunker now. I'm like, that's it? We can go to the bunker now? I'm like, so we go, we sit in the bunker and we're just hanging out. But that's probably like the most exciting story on that one. But that's how my introduction to Iraq was, a sandstorm and then, you know, a firefight, right? Like right in the first week of being there.
So
right?
How long were you there?
I was there for about 4 months.
Okay.
So came back, and I'll never forget, man, 142, they went through the ringer, right? Those dudes, when I showed up, they looked rough. You know, I'm this fresh cat at AIT, don't have a clue what's
going
on.
They'd already been there 11 months, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they got extended to 15, so originally I wasn't going to go because the thought was they were going to come home, but when they found out they got extended, they were like, you're going over. So ended up going over there, came back, you know, a lot of good dudes, but you know, like the typical Army term, you meet some guys, you kind of form a bond with them in a family, and then everybody kind of goes wherever they got to go, PCS, ETS, kind of, you know, the typical Army thing, as you will. And then I had a few that I went back to Iraq with, and I think that's when I really had the bond with some of the guys in the Army there, because you remember Adam Jolliffe. He came to the unit right around that time. Well, right after we got back and I met him, kind of a mutual friend we have. But and then I met my ex-spouse. She's from Washington, and had my first kid, so Opie was born. That was just after.
That was just after, cause the second him deployment. And, yeah, that's right. Because our kids are all around the same age.
Yeah, that was just after the second deployment.
So did you meet her prior to?
I met her when I came back from the second deployment.
Okay.
Yep. I was living with, so, you know, the barracks up there, you're very familiar with, not great. So after that deployment, you know, I'm a big Saj at this time, and I got all the money in the world.
You get a comma on your paycheck at this time.
Yeah. So I we moved off post. It was me and two other E5s, and you know, they were great dudes. Sean and Patrick. Patrick's a real estate agent now up in Ohio, and Sean's a police officer in Nebraska. They all got out, but ended up moving out with them. They were kind of back and forth on what they were going to do. And I met my ex-spouse up there, and then I kind of moved out and got married. you know, started my own family, man. And then, you know, when kids happen, it's like, you don't know what's going on, man. Like at that time, it's time, it's really time to learn. Like, cause at that point, it's not about yourself anymore.
Yeah.
Even though I think we still struggle, even at, on, you know, the early ages, we all learn, we're all learning when we're raising kids and stuff like that. It's a, it's hard to balance it out. Right. But, shortly after that, decided I was going to go be special, I guess is what the people would refer it to. And that's when I met you.
So I was going to ask you, so you guys moved from Washington to Georgia for a short time. Was that the first time that she had been away from home?
That was the first time she was away from home. So, and
what was that like for your guys' marriage?
I think it was good, man, at first. She actually was a big proponent for it. I think she wanted to be away.
I remember you telling me, yeah.
I think she wanted to see something different because, like, you know, obviously she's from the Seattle area, and she wanted to get out there and kind of see what the world had to offer. But obviously, like, her world's changed too at that time, right? Yeah. We got a kid that we just brought into the world. And at the time, I'm like changing my mind 900, you know, ways on what I want to do with my life. Do I just want to stay in the regular Army or do I want to go do something? And I started teasing out going into, you know, special operations prior to even leaving JBLM, but I never really pulled the trigger. There was a guy, he was an E7, he wanted to do it. CA was pretty new at the time for a lot of people. I mean, I know they'd been around, but the whole selection process was very new. So because it was something I was kind of interested in prior to going to Fort Stewart, I was like, when I got down there, I immediately linked in with a recruiter and started talking to them and figuring that out. And I'll never forget, someone told me, one of the NCOs and the first sergeant was like, you got to do at least a year here. I said, I don't think that's how this works. Like, it's kind of like one of those hold my beer moments. Like, I'm going to see what happens. So we went to selection, got selected, but came back, obviously shared the good news and the good story. And then, dude, I, like, Fort Stewart, man, like, you know all about Fort Stewart. Like, it's not where I wanted to be. We lived in a pretty decent area in Richmond Hill, but Hinesville is a dumpster fire. And there was, like, no way she was going to live in Hinesville, and I knew that, so we had to live a little bit. That drive down 44 is rough, man. Like, that hour and 10-minute drive is what I would equate it to. She was not having that, and I was not having it either, right? So I would reach out to the branch manager like daily after I got selected. I was like, dude, how do we get myself out of here? Like, I gotta go, man. Like, I'm not doing this anymore, you know? And, you know, I think part of that was just my desire to want to start to that process. So I finally got out of there, and man, I'll never forget, like, 6 months to the date, I had my orders, and 10 months to the date, I was out of there. And I think I looked at that first sergeant, I was like, fuck you, like I'm out of here, dude. I'm not doing a year here. So that was good. Then, you know, we show up and it's airborne school and the whole pipeline process, right?
I can't remember. Did we meet at
airborne school, man? Me,
that's
you,
right, right?
And Drake Curry.
It was the whole clan, yep. Right? It was everybody that we know. And that's where we met, because I knew Drake, right? Drake, another one of the teammates we have here. But yeah, Drake and I both came from Hawaii at that time.
Yeah.
Right? And it was this big conglomerate of, you know.
Yeah, man.
At that time, like I think the nostalgia was still there of like, well, this piece of paper says I'm special.
Right.
But, you know what I mean?
We all know.
We didn't even know, like, we didn't even know what the journey was going to begin like.
Right.
So, yeah.
So, you know, then we go through the pipeline, and that is what it is, right?
Yep.
You've relived that twice, and it is what it is, man. Like, it was fine. And then we get to the teams, and we do our thing, and, you know, that was kind of rough at first. But the one thing I can appreciate is, like, I think most people share this sentiment in special operations. Like, they just want you to come in and do a job. And, like, once you do your job, you go home. And it was very much a lot of that through the latter part of my years. And at this point, I'm an E6, and you're an E6 at the time. And, like, we're looking at potentially being E7s in the future and kind of posturing ourselves for that.
How many times did you deploy when you were on a team?
I went to Nepal, Indonesia. I had some time in the Philippines a little bit. I actually went to Bangladesh for a short stint, and then that's about it. My longest time was in Indonesia, man. Yeah. I did a full 6-month rotation while I was there. And
because I asked, because that's the first time since you guys got married that you were really out the door. And I, knowing what I know now, you know, things are still very busy, yeah. But 10 years ago, you were lucky to be home 2 weeks a month.
Yeah.
You were hopping and popping.
And Ken highlights this with you in his last podcast, but it's, you know, we highlight the deployments, but it's not just the deployments.
No.
Because in between there, it's SEER school. It's,
oh, it's all the training.
The TDY.
Yeah, it's everything.
You know, I was in Hawaii for an extended period of time. Yeah. Like, I'm all over the place.
And that's where I meant. That's where I meant, right? Is like,
yeah,
the year that you're at home, you're lucky to get, you were, right? You were lucky to get 2 weeks every month before you were just
right
back out the door again.
So Drake, one of our guys, he knows this story pretty intimately because he was in SEER school with me. I won't get into like SEER school itself, but I would say a two-time graduate of SEER school, okay? Because like I didn't do anything wrong. But I was on a team with teammates that did something that they shouldn't have done. And I went before my daughter was born. So she was born in 2015. And the goal was, like, speaking to my wife at the time, is let's get this done, you know, at the tail end of my pregnancy. That way you can be home. And I would to be out the door to Nepal in November. So we tried to time everything up, and like, probably the worst mistake you can do in the Army is try to time your life up with you know, things that are going on with the Army, because the Army typically always wins and you never can predict success anywhere in the Army. But what I will tell you is, so I go to SEER school at the tail end of summer, obviously, because I didn't want to deal with the cold. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to get through this and it's going to be fine. And I actually go with Drake. So we get through the whole first 2 weeks this year of school, and then we get to the whole, you know, the whole idea of you got to put it all together, and then there's this big culmination event at the end. And so we're at this point where we're like walking through the woods, man, and you know, at this point you're tired. It's, you know, 24, 48 hours of no sleep, and like, you know, you're already getting your ass beat and all this stuff. Like, you're already in just a really shitty state of mind, right? But you're committed to getting through this because, like, I just got to get to the end of this, right? And we're doing this whole, we're walking through the woods, and, you know, we're all delirious, man. We don't know where we're going. And, like, you've got things going on around you that you just, you don't have a clue where you're at, right? You're just hoping you're going the right way. Well, the team's consensus was like, hey, let's take a break. Like, we're in a draw. Let's just, which is the worst place to be, but it's the best place to be in the current situation that we're in. Let's try and get some shut-eye. Like, we'll leave people up, you know, and so, well, we left the two wrong people awake at the time. Because did you get all these briefs like, don't go to the cadre's tent, don't do this, don't do that. Like, don't do something stupid, right? And these two idiots, man, like, bust into the cadre's truck. They didn't realize the cadre were sleeping there. And, you know, we have GPS on, because obviously the Army has to have some sort of parameter in place for what's going on. So they, like, track these dudes back. They, like, blow up the whole team. Like, we're getting woke up. We're thinking, like, we wake up and we grab all of our rucks and we're, like, darting out.
Yeah.
There, man. Like, we're thinking something bad. And all I hear is, team blah, 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 stop fucking moving. Team blah, 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 stop. And we hear it. And I asked, and I said, should we stop moving? And, you know, another guy asked and a girl asked, and all these teammates are asking, like, should we stop? And then we finally were like, yeah, we should stop. Well, these two knuckleheads ended up not saying anything. So the cadre approach us and they're like, what two individuals, like, broke into the back of the truck? And I'm thinking to myself, bro, like, this is not happening right now. And no one fessed up, because all of us are of the mindset that, it wasn't us. You know, it had to be somebody else. And then finally, those two dudes come, you know, they come full circle, and they're like, hey, we kind of broke into the back of the truck looking for food. And we're like, dude, no way. And then at that point, we knew it was over, man. What we didn't know is, were they going to kick those two dudes out, or were they going to kick the whole team out? Well, they ended up taking the whole team back to Camp McCall. And at that point, I knew it was over. And so what a lot of people don't know is, like, if your team gets kicked out, you sit there while the whole class goes through. So we sat there for 7 days. We were hoping we were going to get a reinsert, the guys that didn't do anything, but they never reinsert us. So I spent, you know, 19 days away from my family to come back to tell my wife I failed SEER school, but it wasn't my fault. But, like, how do you believe it? Well, you know, I didn't get the NTR paperwork that two of those Bubba's got. I got the, hey, you can return as soon as possible. So I came back.
Showed up to work, and they went, see ya.
Yep. Showed up to work. I had my daughter, and we got out of the hospital, and she was born, and I was in SEER school again. And that was probably the first mistake I made in my marriage, obviously, is that I chose, you know, something that didn't have to happen at the moment rather than be home.
And I want to get into that after about, because we've shared this sentiment tons. And as we go on to talk about maybe not classifying it as it being your identity, but how your family took a back seat.
Yeah.
Because you make a really good point that, like, that was probably the first mistake, because, you know.
Yeah, that was probably my first mistake is, like, I didn't want to be home, but you have the pressures of work, you know, yeah, that are on you. And it's like, I'm not a failure. I've never failed anything in my life. Like, yeah, I talk about high school, but, like, that's high school, man. We're growing up. And I'm not saying that, but it molded me. Like, failing there molded me to who I am. So at that point, I was like, I'm not going to fail ever again. But I felt like a failure. Even though I didn't do anything wrong in that situation, I felt like a failure. So, you know, I see Drake, and Drake's graduated, and I'm thinking to myself, like, dude, how am I even going to, like, face one of my good friends and tell them what happened? How am I going to face my command team and let them know? And, like, but they got word. They knew it wasn't my fault, but it didn't matter. I still had to go back through it because I had to have that qualification, right? So I ended up going back to SEER school, and that was false. But I'll never feel like the vindication I had when one of the instructors walked up to me at the end of SEER school, and he's like, were you a part of the previous class? Because they had a cycle break in there. I said, yeah. He was like, dude, we should have never kicked you out. And I was like, yes! Like, finally someone gets it! I'm thinking to myself, like, thank God, dude. Like, someone validated my feelings, and I'm like, oh, thank God. But, you know, getting through it, obviously, you learn a lot about yourself. I mean, I think we've all it's the best school I never want to go back to ever again. You know, I learned a lot about myself, but I'll never would I want to go through that school ever again. But it was a good time. That was probably my first mistake. And I don't know if you, like, what you really want to get into on that, but I think that was the first time that I chose my career over my family. And there's going to be several more in those in my story where I make those choices. But, you know, you'll see as I learn through it that I still, you know, began to better myself as I got older.
How did she take it?
She was super supportive. I'll give her that. She knew it. But what I haven't brought up is after I graduated SEER school the second time, a week later, I was in Nepal. Now, I didn't choose Nepal. You know, the team was chosen for Nepal, and we knew that. But I could have not gone to SEER school, stayed with her, helped raise our little girl, and, you know, obviously we had Opie at the time. Really invest in those first, you know,
month
of their life that matters, and then put her in a better situation when I went on that JSET to Nepal, and then come back and done SEER school. Because, you know, now I know that's not what the branch is about. The branch is about, they're about your family, but I didn't share that information with them, you know, so it's 100% on me. But I thought I was doing the right things because the job I had at the time was giving me the purpose. You know, she was a stay-at-home mom. So I felt like the more that I was doing, the better I was setting myself up for success later in the Army. But that probably was the first mistake. And then Nepal was fine. It was whatever, you know, it was like 30 days. I came back, dude, I got super sick when I got back from Nepal, like so sick to the point that I came home on the flight sick, and it was a continued sickness through like Thanksgiving, like super sick, like thought I was gonna have to go to the hospital, like the food got to me or something. But that was fine. And then it kind of slowed down, right? We went into PMT. I would say it slowed down. It slowed down that I wasn't going to a SEER school. I wasn't. Now it's the TDY and the ramp up to going out the door for Indonesia. So I guess at this point, we're what, 3 years, kind of 3 years into there at that time?
Less than that.
Yeah, a little less than that.
So you're less than that. School, gone.
Yeah. Out the
home for a week, out to Nepal for a month, came back for basically November to January.
Yep.
Showed right back up at work.
Yep.
And then PMT started.
PMT started in January.
Is everything, for people that don't know, right? Everything that you need to be able to get out the door, which when we talk about TDY, like, yes, those are the trips that you're away from home. Yep. But a lot of times what people don't think about is all the training you do at home station that you're not home for.
Yeah, man. We're doing range time, the typical, everything you got to do to ramp up to get out. We're at MRX, we're in Georgia, we're in Hawaii, we're all over the place. I'm currently in the 97th Civil Affairs Battalion as their Battalion S2, and I was on a team as an acting team sergeant in the 97th Delta Company at that time. So it's all come full circle now. Now I'm an officer there. I was an enlisted swine, I guess you could say at the time. I don't know. But, you know, I'm just joking everybody about that. I feel my enlisted folks out there because I lived it for quite some time, right?
How did you balance it, or how did she take it when you jumped right into PMT and you had that sense of like, because as long as I've known you, you've always been better about it than me. We've gotten much better as we've gotten older, and I've learned a lot from you. I really have, and we've had so many conversations about this. But we were both running hard.
I guess, you know, the self-reflection was I knew I could have handled the SEER school situation a little bit better, but I never talked about it. You know, I never had those conversations with her. So I would internalize a lot of that stuff, and I would just try and grow from it internally and then hope that my presence at home would shine through enough that it would calm her, right? I think she was, like I said, she was super supportive through those years, and she knew what she signed up for. I mean, she wasn't naive to it. She had a brother and still has a brother that's in the Air Force, and he's super successful. So I think he helped, and then just with the conversations on like, hey, this is just an expectation. He's in special operations as well, just on the Air Force side. So I think she got it. But even though someone understands, you still don't know how they're dealing with it inside. And I don't think that I truly understood what she was going through. Because I know it's hard, you know, she'd moved away. She didn't have her family. We both didn't have her family. Mine's a little closer. And I think that having some family about 3 hours away, because I told you I'm from Columbia, South Carolina, helped the situation, but it didn't make it easy on anybody. Because, you know, at that time, they were in a very six on, six off. So the thought was, I'm going to go on this six-month rotation, come back, and I'd be out the door into the PM, you know, I'd have 6 months to do individual training. I'd have 6 months to do PMT again, and we'd be out the door. And some guys were, like I said, were getting in there. They were six on, six off. They'd come back, they'd reset for 6 months, and they'd be out the door. I mean, the team sergeant that went with me forward to Indonesia didn't even initially go with me right away because he had just returned from the Philippines like 4 months later. So he like, they gave him a little extra time, and then he showed up in Indonesia and he took over as a team sergeant duty. I'm not going to share his name, but he had a real profound impact on my life while I was in Indonesia. He was probably the dude that brought me to Jesus, you know.
Yeah. You want to take a break?
Yeah.
Let's take a break. All right. We're back. Let's pick it up with the man who had an impact on you.
Yeah, man. So Chris just had a, he was persistent, right? He'd be like, hey man, like we should do these devotionals. And I'm like, I'd always been kind of, I was brought to the church and faith was a big part of my family and everything. So I was always in church. I just never was like a practicing Christian, I guess you could say. But Chris took the time to really share the word, you know? So we go through Indonesia, and like we actually went to a church in Indonesia. Like he found one, like we went to it, and like it was a great time. And so that's probably where I would say that my life started to shift and towards the whole idea of like I needed to be a little bit more focused on my family, you know. So trying to change just my perspective, I was fine. I had no issues. Coming up in the army or whatever, I didn't have clear thoughts, I guess you could say. And he kind of cleared my mind, when he brought me, to Christ. So I remember sitting in Indonesia and I'm thinking to myself, like, what am I going to do next? Like, I don't know that I can do this, the six on, six off. And I know it's gotten better. But this is going to be difficult. And I think I knew that she was having a hard time with it. But I started thinking of, like, not really an exit strategy because I wasn't going to get out of the army. Like, what can I do next to, like, focus on my family? And this is where we link up again, Chad.
Mind you, we stayed in contact this whole time, right?
Like, yeah. But, you know, I get a while. I was like, I think I'm going to go be an officer. And you're like, what?
And at that point you knew I had other aspirations and was pursuing other jobs within the special operations realm.
Right. And I'm thinking to myself,
and you were like the State Farm commercial that was like, hey.
I was like,
hey,
let's go do this, man. Like, let's just go be officers.
Do you remember what I said to you?
I vaguely remember you basically telling me to kick rocks. There's no way you're ever going to do that.
And then I remember saying to you, like, even though we work with them, I don't even know what they do. Like, they're summer help, man. They're here for a little bit and then they leave.
And mind you, I had no officer mentoring me at the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, like, yeah.
It was me who's an E6 and Chris who's an E7 medic. So you'd think like my path is going to be, it should be a medic, you know? I'm like, nah, I think I'm going to go be an officer. Like, and I'd be lying if I told you, you look at a pay scale and you're like, oh my God, like that,
yeah,
that's a no brainer. But getting my degree was always important to me. I think it became even more important to me when I started to have these self-reflections of like, how am I going to like, you know, really fulfill my family's name, which my mom's an educator, my sister's an educator. What am I going to do to like honor her, right? Because all she ever wanted me to do was go to college and have some success there. So at 30 years old, I'm like, I can do this. I'd been working on my degree a little bit here and there. So the process was pretty easy, you know? We applied. We got picked up. Like, we both found out at the same time. You were like, I was trying to convince you to go to Campbell. I was like, hey, we'll go be like the Bad News Bears at Campbell University. Like, let's go do this, man. And I was actually kind of bummed, man. I'm not gonna lie. When you were like, nah, man, I think I'm gonna go back to Hawaii. And I'm like, I don't have any friends anymore. I'm thinking to myself, like, this is terrible, dude. Like, I convinced you to do this, but I couldn't convince you to go to Campbell University. But it was fine. Like, you know, it was the best move for my family. I think it was the best move for your family. So we stayed here. And if anybody knows anything about it, I mean, it's 2 years. It's kind of like a hiatus. You kind of just do college and there's no Army, right?
For you.
Yeah, your program was wild. I wouldn't say that we didn't do anything, but it wasn't difficult.
Yeah.
You know, we did some things. But and then I commissioned, man, in 2019. And now I'm like, oh, God. Like, I just accidentally became important at work, and I didn't mean to, you know? And so I showed up, and I'm thinking to myself, like, at this time, like, there's nothing going on in the world, right? Like, yeah, we had the ISIS stuff that happened in the 2015 era and all that stuff, and then Afghanistan was kind of ramping down. Not really. Like, people were still deploying, but, like, you weren't hearing about the deployments.
Yeah.
And there weren't the deployments to Iraq this frequent. So I'm thinking to myself, and I'm trying to sell my wife at the time. And I'm like, it's fine. I'm going to go to the 82nd. It's going to be fine. I'm like, we're just going to be training all the time. And I meet a couple guys, like they were in the course there in the 82nd. They talk about it all the time. And really, I just didn't want to move. She liked the stability. And the kids have, you know, Opie moved here when he was two. And then my other two, Atlas was born while I was going through the ROTC program. And Atlas, you know, he's kind of new to all this, and he'll probably never really understand the Army because I'll retire before he really fully grasps it all. But I decided to stay here. Went to Campbell University. It's about 40 minutes away from here. Commissioned. My initial assignment was JBLM Washington, and I was like, oh, I can't go back there. You know, I'm not going to revisit that place. You actually got JBLM Washington, and I was able to switch, and I ended up getting the 82nd Airborne. So first stint as an officer in the 82nd, and this is when things really get rocky, not because of anything that I did. It's just circumstances that you fall in on, right? Everything's normal, man. You know, you show up, you in process, everything's going great. They put you in your unit and you're thinking to yourself, all right, cool, so I'm going to go on block leave and come back, and then I'm really going to kind of get out. I show up in November, do like a quick exercise with them, and we had a trip scheduled to Disney World that year. We had this plan for, you know, back in the summer. We're like, we're going to go to Disney World. And we're in Disney World, and I think I'm standing in a line, and I get a phone call, like, and I ignore it. It's, you know, my OIC, and I'm like, he'll just leave. At this point in my life, I'm like, if it's important, you'll leave a voicemail. I'm not answering everything. And then he called back. Well, I'll back up a little bit. They told us prior to Block Lee, we were going to be the IRB-1. So that's the company within our battalion is the IRB-1, which makes the battalion the IRB. That's the immediate response battalion that will go out the door in the event that something's going to happen. And I'll never forget my commander's speech to all of us before we went on Block Lee. He was like, you know, we'll be ready for the nation's call if something happens, you know. But he jokingly said, like, you know, it's been 30 years since anything's ever happened. Dude. And I swear that's the moments that he jinxed us, you know. So we're in Disney World, and I get that phone call, and he called twice. And the second time, he just picks up the phone, and he's like, hey, man, have you watched the news? And I'm like, nah, man, I'm at Disney World. He's like, you should probably watch the news. And I'm like, man, what is going on that I need to turn on the news right now? And at this point, I'm not big. Like, I kind of turn off, shut off from the entire world because I'm trying to spend time with my family. But I bring up a news station and I read it, and I'm like, okay, so there's something going down in Iraq. And if you remember, that's when there was this thought that the embassy could get ran over, which ensued with the killing of Soleimani. So I get back to the hotel, and that was the first time, and we keep kind of watching the news, and something told me, man, we were prepared to leave the next day, but something told me we needed to go ahead and get on the road. I looked at my wife, I got my three kids, and I said, we gotta start heading back. I don't know why, but we just need to do it. So we get on the road, and it wasn't until we got to Savannah, I got the call. And it was like, you need to be at the battalion headquarters in 8 hours. And I'm making phone calls and letting them know, I'm like, I'm 8 hours away. Now, mind you, I'm on leave. I'm allowed to do this. Like, we knew we were fine, but I'm thinking to myself, and I'm trying to calm. I'm thinking to myself, there's no way this is going to happen, right? I'm trying to calm down my family. My kids don't have a clue what's going on. You could see my spouse at the time with her. She was kind of in disbelief that something was about to happen. But, that's what we signed up to do, man. And I showed up to the battalion. I had all my stuff packed. I get home. I say my goodbyes, and I take all my stuff, and I show up to the battalion headquarters. And that's New Year's Eve, man. We had a party planned. We were going to do some stuff with some friends.
And I'd like to say, our relationship, is, we've gotten so close over the years that I remember you called me when that happened.
Yeah, dude.
And your initial reaction was like, man, what the?
Yeah, I mean, and then, I was in disbelief. I was like, there's no way this is going to happen.
And I remember when you called me when you left the house. I vividly remember that. And you were like, dude, I hope I get there and just leave my bags and come home.
I did that for 24 hours, man.
Yeah.
And I'm in disbelief because of the whole situation, one that we even left. I mean, it was coined the Devil New Year, because 1st Brigade's the devil in baggy pants, right, in the 82nd. But I'm thinking to myself, like, this is wild to me. Like, what are we going to do in Iraq, Because I'm thinking, like I told you earlier, like, there's nothing going on over there. So, sure enough, man, 18 hours, the first boots are out the door. That motto that the 18th Airborne Corps pushed and the 82nd Airborne pushes, like, they got the first boots out the door, and I was in disbelief. Now, everybody else that went out the door, it took some time. But here's where it gets interesting for me. So I'm on the second bird that leaves. The battalion commander's on the first bird. We are in the air. They have this system that they're talking back and forth on. They land in Germany, and their plane breaks down. We land, but our plane didn't break down. They just fueled, we got off, refit, and stuff like that, and we kept going on. We were under the impression that the battalion commander had made it all the way to Kuwait, only to find out that it was me. So everybody that's supposed to be, like, the battalion staff primaries are on the plane with the battalion commander, and all the secondary, staff primaries are sitting in Kuwait. Like, well, what are we supposed to do? Like, I have the XO, the three with me, and we're like, we don't even know where we're going, because he's got all the information, and they're not sharing it. We didn't have a whole lot of communication. The little communication, we didn't have what we needed to know. We didn't know where we were going, who we were supposed to link up with. So we land in Kuwait, and then they're like, hey, there's these 47s. They're here for y'all. And they loaded us up. We were there for like 45 minutes, loaded us up on a 47. It was like 12 of us. I'm like, we can fit more. They're like, nah, it's just going to be all 12. And then we'd end up in Iraq. I'm like, I'm sitting there with my XO, and I'm like, sir, what the fuck are we doing here? Like, what are we supposed to be doing right now? And he had no clue. Like, he's just like, well, we landed at Taji. So fortunate for those guys, I had been there. Now, everything's changed, because that was back in 07, 08, but it still had an eerie, familiar feeling. And I'm like, well, there should be these buildings over here. I know where the defect was. And I'm like trying to find, but I don't know who to link up with. We ended up finding like the base ops commander, and he kind of links in. He's like, what? I don't even know what the fuck you are doing here. He's a Canadian at the time. He's like, I'm just supposed to provide life support for a battalion's worth of infantrymen. Like, no one knew why we showed up, but we showed up. So we're there, and not more than 3 hours into being there, we walk into the defect, because they're serving midnight chow. And if you know, anybody knows Midnight Chow is the best.
Always the best chow.
in any war zone. And we walk in and the news is on and they're running headlines about Soleimani and where he's at and all this stuff. And shortly after that, Soleimani's killed, like 2 days later. Like, what the fuck, dude? And I'm thinking to myself, prior to that, we got here, there's nothing going on. No one's like, you can't send a bunch of infantry buffets out there in Iraq. Like, no one's going to allow that to happen. So they're just sitting around. So I'm like, dude, we're just going to go home. We're going to turn around and go right back home and everything's going to be fine. Dude, and that happened. And I thought we were about to kick off World War III at that time. So that happens. And I'm sitting there and the BC brings everybody in. He's like, your stay just got extended to the Hotel Iraq. And I'm like, oh, God, not again, you know? So we're sitting in Iraq and, you know, he's trying to figure out, he's attending meetings left and right. And then I'll never forget, man, January 7th, 2020 was when Iran decided to take its revenge on us, and they launched all those TCBMs. I think they launched some like 29, and a bunch of them went up to Al-Assad. Some of them came down to Taji. They were all over Iraq, dude. And that was the first time that I thought in any war zone that I'd ever been in, and I'm not talking like gunshots or whatever, man, yeah, like getting shot at, except getting blown up. But this is kind of equivalent to that, you know, not knowing what's coming. I thought I was going to lose my life. I had a specialist as a young lieutenant sit below me, and he looked at me and he thought he was going to lose his life. He was 21 years old at the time. And he said, sir, I don't really know what to ask you, but what's your favorite color? And we're sitting underneath a desk and I'm like, that's what you want to ask me right now? He was like, I don't know what to ask you. He's like, I just feel like I need to get to know you. And like, we had a full long conversation about, you know, our family, our history. And I still, you know, keep in touch with him to this day. But that was the first time that I really thought that I was going to lose my life and I was never going to see my kids again or my wife. And that moment, you know, just kind of illuminated the idea that I needed to continue this path on like taking care of my family, you know? So we were there for about 3 months, came back, and we thought it was all over, you know, but the brigade was still over there. In Kuwait and kind of in and out of Iraq, and then they came back, and then no sooner than we could hit the ground, dude, we were activated again.
How long were you back for, you think?
30 days, maybe 35. And I'm like, what are we doing this time? And this is in response to all the riots, man. So we got back in March, and in May they sent us up to D.C. So that was all over the news, man. This isn't, you know, something that the world hasn't seen, but they sent the entire battalion up to Washington, D.C. as if we were going to be some, you know, riot force against all the protests that were going on in the world. And I remember my BC looking at me, he's like, I need you to help me out. Like, can you do IPB? And I'm like, sir, I can't do that. Like, I'm an intelligence officer. These are American people. I can't do it. And he's like, oh, yeah, you're right. I was like, so don't ask me anything crazy. I was like, hopefully we show up and the FBI is there and we can like get some guidance from them. And sure enough, that was as organized as it could be, but it wasn't super organized. You know, we got up there and we basically sat for 2 weeks. Dude, at the same time, this is when COVID is running rampant through everyone. So our entire battalion ended up with, the entire battalion ended up with COVID, come back. Like, we're up there for 2 weeks and we're thinking to ourselves, like, why did we just send a bunch of dudes up to D.C. to twiddle their thumbs and then come back? So we come back, and that's, I don't want to constitute that, but that was the second activation. It's not a deployment, but it's the second activation of not knowing what you're going to do. You're just answering the nation's call, right? Or whatever's going on. But that was wild, man, right? For everybody, because even these infantry buffets are like, like, what are you asking me to do? Like, and you can see where I'm going to this. Like, you're going to put a bunch of active duty soldiers on the ground? Like, what are you asking us to do? That's not what we're built for. And I think that was tough for guys to kind of grapple with what the possibility of them being asked to do. And even me, and I could see it was weighing on the BC pretty hard. And he was done, man. Like, when he came back, I asked him, I had my OER out counseling with him. I asked him what he was going to do. And he's like, man, I'm retired. I'm done with this. So we return, and, you know, because we've had this like 6 months of like craziness going on, they're starting, the 82nd's kind of, they're backing off on 1st Brigade, and they're allowing us to kind of reset. But we had to get, you know, current with our jumps and all that stuff. And I had a pretty bad jump in between that time when I got back and when I really got back into it. And that's when I tore my hip, labrum, and I had a TBI. That the BC that I was just talking about, he had a pretty bad concussion during that one, and that's when my body started to tell me you need to slow the fuck down. So I get through. I end up going to a PL position, and then do that for about 6 months. And then, man, I go up to the division headquarters, thinking I'm getting away from all this nonsense that the brigades are going through.
How was your marriage at this point?
It was better, I guess you could say, because now she thought I'm going to division headquarters, like things are going to get a little easier. Because you don't deploy a division, right? Like, that's where my head's at. Little do I know when I get up there. You know, the guy, the CG at the time, was a hard charger. And I think he was good for the 82nd. I just think it exacerbated what they were already going through, right? Because you've got to give guys time to reset. Just because you come in fresh doesn't mean that everybody below you is fresh. And I think people lose sight of that. And I understand that you got to have people ready, but there's got to be a balance through all that. And I don't think that it was managed, because 1st Brigade was getting hammered with it left and right. And that didn't really change when I got up to the division headquarters. I think there was a lot of, 1st Brigade's done it, so we're going to continue to hit that comfort button that we have and keep sending them out the door. So we get up to division, man, and I'm up there for a while, and things are fine. But Afghanistan starts to get a little squirrely at this time. And I know you have your rotation over there, so a little bit more extensive background than me. But I've read enough, and I know enough about what's going on over there, that what we're seeing on the news and what we're reading, there's some truth to it, right? And what they didn't know is how fast Afghanistan was going to fall. So we started receiving those kind of hints in May that it was going to fall pretty quickly. And it did, man. And then the division was activated again, and here we go again, man. I'm thinking to myself, dude, I'm either like a bad apple and everywhere I go, someone else is going to get fucked, or I'm just that lucky. You know, I don't know what it is. So here we go again, out to Afghanistan. And I'm like, dude, this has got to come to an end. Now, I will say we were there for a very short amount of time, but in the time that we were there, it was crazy, man. They come back, and then things kind of settle down, and then fucking Ukraine kicks off, man. And you're like, what does this have to do with us? And you know, at this time, I'm at my wit's end, man. I'm on borrowed time with the Army. I'm already injured. I'm like, I can't keep doing this. And she is, my wife is, she can't do it anymore. You know, like I could tell this is starting to weigh on her, because this is the fourth time in 2 years that I'm going out the door, and I have no clue when I'm coming back. My oldest at the time is absolutely fed up with it. And just before Iraq happened, our youngest had a tragic incident happen to him where he got hit in the back of the head with a baseball. When he got hit in the back of the head with a baseball, it required surgery. We thought we were going to lose him. Dude, we got lucky, is what I will tell you, is that when he went to the hospital, while it was bad and it required surgery, it didn't do enough damage to require him to stay in the hospital for an extended period of time, and he was still able to come home prior to Christmas. So with all these activations that I went through and then that happening, I'm thinking to myself, like, there's no way they're going to send. Now, this one was a little bit more controlled chaos. And when I say it's controlled chaos, it's because the flights couldn't get figured out. So people were leaving at very, you know, different times and all that stuff. I got through about 30 days of being home, and he was pretty stable. But I know she was about to go through it with all of his appointments and just making sure he was taken care of. And I was approached by a major, and he was like, Mike, he's like, they could really use you over there. And I'm thinking to myself, like, don't do this to me, man. Like, don't guilt me into leaving my kid. And I could feel myself slipping back into career versus family, career versus family. And I told him, I said, sir, I'd really rather not go. And I said, if that makes me less of an officer to you, like, so be it, you know. That didn't change his mind. They still brought me forward. But ultimately, he did give me the ability to choose whether or not I go. So I did have a conversation with my spouse, and we decided it was probably, you know, the best thing for me to go forward. But, man, I remember the phone call every night and asking about him and how she's doing, and he wasn't doing very well. I mean, we had to fly my mom. I'm not fly her up here. She had to drive up here pretty frequently just to help out. And while I was over there, man, I was a wreck. I mean, I'd battled depression. I mean, everything. I was like, my head's not here. Like, if something, like, while we're sitting in Poland, were to kick off, like, I'm not going to be in a good place to take care of these guys, you know? So enough kicking and screaming, I guess you can. But it was a legitimate, you know, concern. Like, I needed to get home. So I came back about May time. I left in February and came back about May, so I could be with them. And then they came home shortly after that too. So it ended up working out for everybody, but from that moment forward, man, like, I went through the ringer, you know? And I think she was dealing with it, because that was my, Atlas and I bonded because I was actually, you know, here, and I stayed through a lot of his birth. And so, like, it, and then I was there for the incident. And I think that moment was just galvanizing for me, but it pained me to be away from him while he was going through all of this treatment. And then when I returned, man, I went on, like, just, I had to keep my mind busy, you know? So I would take him to his appointments. I mean, I was finding any and every way I could get out of work to be with him, you know? I was like, no, I got an appointment, you know? And I think that was the first time that I was like, I'm about to walk away from the Army. Like, this is not for me. And then my marriage starts to go downhill at this point. And, you know, I don't know, man. I did everything I could to keep it together, but I just reached a point where I was like, I can't do this with you anymore. You know, I think
let's take a break.
You know, my marriage starts to fall apart, and I start slipping into this career over family again, right? And I think this is the time that I told you, it was about a year prior, I told you I was going to start my master's degree. And I think you started yours as well.
Well, I got suckered into that one just like you did. Again, with the, what's the point of that? Yeah. I don't even know what it does. And you were like, you should just do it. And next thing I know, here I am.
Here you are doing it, right? And I'm about a year away from completing mine. I had to take a hiatus because I went over to Poland for a little while. And she was also doing her master's degree. And I think this is the first moment that you could see the family unit start to you know, the strings start to pull apart from each other. I'm very focused on myself. She's very focused on herself. And she becomes very concerned with what, you know, how she's going to take care of herself and what she wanted to do. And, you know, I don't fault her for the several years prior to that. She's trying to hold the family together and do it all. So, you know, I give her part of my GI Bill. She goes to school. She finishes her bachelor's degree. She wants to start her master's, and she starts her master's. And probably the biggest mistake I made was trying to start my master's at the exact same time. She starts to formulate her new identity, if you will. You know, my identity is still with the Army. You know, I'm getting my master's degree to hedge against anything that the future may hold for us. And if I use it, great. If not, it's not the end of the world, you know. She was going to use hers to become a marriage counselor. And she ultimately ends up doing so. I think that's great. But there's this sense to me, and this is how this is Mike's interpretation of the situation, but she becomes very distant from not only me, but also that of the kids. And that just didn't sit well with me, you know. And through several outings that she had and things that she was doing with friends, it just, we never really felt like we were the same as we were, right? And I'll kind of leave all the details out of it because it gets pretty nasty. But I got to a breaking point where I was like, I can't do this anymore, and I had to walk away. And so I walked away. And I wrestled with that, man. I think for 3 months I slept upstairs in our guest room with my all three kids in the bed, thinking to myself, like, the decision I make, you know, breaks this up. And I knew what I was exchanging. I was exchanging, you know, a split household for a little bit of relief when the going get tough, I guess, if you will. You know, and I couldn't do it anymore, man. You know, the statistic where like 55% of marriages, all first marriages in, like, I guess I'm on the winning side of that. If you look at numbers and how they work, right, 55 is higher than 45, and we all kind of live with that. It's not where I wanted to be. It's not something I wanted to add to my resume, but I couldn't do it anymore, you know. I have this very, you know, specific idea what a family unit's supposed to look like, and if it wasn't, it wasn't there. And I wanted to support her in every way that I could, and that's why I, you know, drained my GI Bill to allow her to do what she wanted. I just wanted to be a part of it, and I wasn't either allowed to, or she didn't want me to be a part of it. So I got to the point where I said, if I'm going to do it alone, I'll just do it alone. And I think she's doing well now. I know she's remarried, and it seems like they have an okay life, or a great life. And knowing that I never want to talk bad about my kids and their mom, I think we're in a good place now. But, you know, the separation was pretty rough. I mean, I was accused of some things that were never even happened, man. I don't know if it was just her lawyer and how he wanted to phrase things. I mean, but ultimately I was faced with the idea that I was never going to see my kids again. And much like yourself and everybody else that we know, man, you don't present me with the fight that you're not willing to fight with. And so at that time, that became my war, you know. And I did everything I could. And ultimately, it ended amicably, but it didn't seem like it was going to go that way at first. I think I got a pretty good lawyer that took care of me. She had one that took care of her. And ultimately, it ended the way that it was supposed to end. And I think that kind of goes to, you know, just believing in my faith and, like, praying every night and understanding that no matter what happens, everything happens for a reason. And as long as God's in my corner, I'll be just fine. You know, you're a great friend, Chad, but one of my best friends, he lives out here. He's a pharmacist. He really kept it together for me, you know. I met him about three years prior to all this happening. And it was probably perfect timing, right? Because Chris exits my life because I become an officer, and then he is inserted in my life, and he continued to draw me closer and closer to Christ. He prayed over me. You know, he asked if this is what I wanted to do. And, you know, from a biblical standpoint, it's not how you want it to end, you know. But I told him, I said, I couldn't do it, dude. And so, you know, without the dudes in my corner and God in my corner and everything, I don't know if I'd be standing here today, man. But baseball, it all comes back to baseball. And meeting him, and we stay on the field, and we've been coaching since Opie was 8, and his son, they have a bond. I have a bond with this dude. And it's just ensured that I'm still standing here.
And you're able to coach and, like, help all those dudes each and every day. And every time you go out there, and you have such a passion for it. And I think, you know, we've talked about it so many times, but I think, like, we classify, like, this whole person concept is somebody of a human performance, right? Like, and your performance is based off of your physical fitness, your mental fitness, your emotional fitness, your spiritual fitness, and everything you keep talking about, right, keeps rounding back around that, right? Whether it's like your mental state, your emotional state, your spiritual state. All those things got to be in balance, you know? And you've had times, we've all had times where they come out of balance. And when it comes out of balance, you start leaning towards, you know, those things that will continue to put you out of balance, career, you know? And like you said, it always comes back to baseball because Chris has been that guy that helps you stay on that, like, you know, as you described too, like that spiritual path, right? You're already a physically fit dude. I mean, that's something like you're never going to stop. But getting out there with those kids, being able to help them build resiliency through reps and, like, mastering the basics, as you always talk about, helps them build that mental resiliency. And you see in yourself too, like, when they get upset now, and I mean, we've talked about it hundreds of times, like, when they build in those basic reps or they're able to do those things and build some confidence, they don't get emotional.
Right?
And it really brings back, like, that whole piece there. And, man, as long as I've known you, like, I think we've both grown. But I think everything you've faced, like, you've grown in every single one of those aspects. And you're going to continue to grow. And you're getting so much back from giving back.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, man. I mean, like, I live to be on that field with those kids, man. Like I told you, you know, I thought I was going to lose my kid. Like, I don't know what I'd do if I couldn't coach Opie, you know. It's not about him making the majors. Like, that's his dream. I think that's every kid's dream, like I said earlier. But it's not about that, you know. It's about growing each and every one of them and growing him to build a great foundation through hard work and going after your goals and looking at that stuff. So when I thought he was potentially going to get ripped away from me, man, I went into a dark place. So then it became baseball, and that's how I connected, you know, even more so with him. And now we have an unbreakable connection when it comes to baseball, just sports in general. You know, he plays soccer as well. I mean, super athletic kid, super talented. He's a very smart kid in school. Atlas is the same way. But it's connecting through those kids and being in an environment where you can teach them, you know, about your life experiences and how you can use things that they're interested in and apply those to what they can, you know, what they're going to do in the future, right? That's really where it comes into. And I've been coaching now, I guess it's going on 6 years, you know, getting away from playing it to now coaching it. It's a different side of the game. And it's also, it has its ups and downs, man. These are 12-year-old kids, man. They're full of emotion, full of testosterone and everything. A lot of them are starting to go through puberty and stuff like that. So it presents its own challenges. But at the end of the day, like, I find comfort in knowing that I can mold those young men into being good men of character through the game of baseball. Because it really is a lot more, man. But, the separation was hard. Like I said, I went through some dark moments, and I don't even think I've shared a lot of those with you, but as you can imagine, I mean, there was times that I didn't know what I'd do if I lost my kids. I became laser focused on making sure that at a minimum, I was going to get, half their time. I'm happy to say that I do half their time. We are in a better spot now with co-parenting, but co-parenting has its challenges. Like I said, she's remarried, so that presented some challenges early on with her bringing another individual in their life. I mean, obviously, I know I can't stop any of that, but, those challenges are that's just life now. That's the path that I chose, but it doesn't change who I am. It doesn't change who their father is, and I understand that. What I think it does, it probably makes me a better father, because not only do I want to show up just because they're my kids, but I want to show up even more because I want to make sure that I don't miss a moment with them now. Even though I know I'm going to miss some time, it's more important now that they're with their mom, they get that time with her, and when they're with me, they get that time with me. And I think, knowing that now, as early on, I didn't know what to expect with splitting time, respecting her time and respecting my time, and I think we do a good job about that now, so. But I think that's pretty much it, man.
I guess we'll wrap it up with, you were one of the first people that I called when I was like, I had this, we'll call it a crazy idea, right, to start something. And I think like we all kind of collectively came up with the name. And I think for a lot of people, but especially you, like you embody, if I had to pick two, it'd be you and Gavin that I think that 100% embody like that name. Because, it's so easy for us to relate to. You got that heavy pack on. And it's not always just stuff you do in the military, but, like, the stuff that you've done, like, in life, right? Like, you're just walking all those dark places. But what you came back on the other side of that and, like, your comeback story and, like, what you can give back to these kids, like, beyond, like, what happened to that is completely invaluable. And, like, I'm super, one, I'm humbled and just awesome. You let me in your family. And you let me at your house to be able to do this. So that's cool. I'm honestly like super excited to see where like this thing goes, man, and watch you like tell your story to multiple other people and help them. Cause somebody out there right now is living exactly what you're going through.
Yeah, man.
And if you could like give them a message or give them a point, it's worth it.
Well, I appreciate it, man.
Thanks, man. Look at that.
Done.
How long was that?
I don't know. You had it timed, right?
No, I turned it off. How long is that? What time is it?
About 2 hours and 13 minutes. Well, y'all showed up at three.
Yeah, so it was like an hour 45. And you didn't even go like deep. No, you did, but like not,
I tried to.
Yeah.
I was thoughtful. So, cool, man. Well, I appreciate it.
No, appreciate you.
Thanks, dude.